So thank you. I'm thrilled to be here to share with you some of the research that my colleagues and I have been working on for the past 3 years in the area of fighting cancer with nanoparticles and nanomedicine. I want to start by saying that the idea of using very, very small vehicles or carriers, nanoparticles, is not new. And so I want to tell you that there was a movie in 1966 called A Fantastic Voyage. And in this Fantastic Voyage, as you can see from the picture, it was a science fiction film. An entire submarine, along with a crew to guide the submarine, was shrunk into a nano size and then injected into the bloodstream of a brilliant scientist that had the information to save the world, but was going to die of a blood clot in his brain. And so this nano carrier of sorts, the submarine, was going to save the world. So let's actually see how they thought in 1966 how this would work. The Fantastic Voyage.
To make a motion picture that crosses a new frontier may seem impossible today. Outer space, the depths of the sea, the bowels of the earth, the past, the future, all have been subjects for the camera. But now, a film called Fantastic Voyage has broken through in an unexpected direction to create an adventure of astonishing suspense and beauty.
So did you see what was happening there? We have the submarine that is actually shrunk in size and then goes through the bloodstream to be able to be guided by these particular submarine crew, including the actress Raquel Welch. And then they reach the brain and they blast the blood clot that is causing the brain problem, and the world is saved. Okay? So that was the idea back in 1966. Let's go back and see where we are now. Okay. All right. So if you think of it, they came up with a fairly simple and elegant approach. They first took a vehicle that they shrunk, a submarine. They put people in the submarine to guide the carrier to its target. And then, once they got to the target, they destroyed the blood clot. Okay? So this was the very simple concept that came out 50 years ago. So where are we now? 50 years later, what has the group that I've been working with done? We've shrunk the vehicle. So we've shrunk the nanocarriers to 27 nanometers. So very small sizes, 10 to the minus 9th meter. We figured out a new way of guiding the carrier to the tumor. And once it gets to the tumor, these nanoparticles are triggered, released by pH, because tumors have a very acid environment, so the linkages holding the drug molecules to the carrier are released, and these drug molecules go out and kill the tumor. So indeed, 50 years later, with a lot more science, we may be able to do some of the things that had been predicted in that science fiction movie so long ago. So indeed, the problem, as we saw it, was any of you who have been a patient, have a friend or family member who has cancer and has been treated by chemotherapy, knows the adverse side effects that chemotherapy causes. Why is that? It turns out that it's because all of these extremely costly drugs, the estimate right now of a new drug to get to FDA approval is $2.6 billion for one drug to get to be approved for a chemotherapeutic. But once those chemotherapeutics are delivered in the body, 98% of them go off target. 98% of the drug molecules do not reach the tumor. They go elsewhere, causing havoc in the body. So in the particular case of a brain tumor, it's often difficult enough to put enough drug into the body without killing the patient, because 98% is going to the wrong place. What did we do? We believed with our targeted nanocarriers that we could transform nanodrug tumor delivery. By getting more of these nanocarriers into the tumor, preferentially taken up by the tumor, and then attaching to each carrier 30 to 100 already approved FDA-approved drug molecules, as well as imaging tracers so we could trace where these nanocarriers went, we believed we could get to safer updosing and reduced off-target effects. So, how did we get to 100 times to 500 times tumor uptake? That's a very good question. It required breakthroughs from three different universities. We had nanochemists at Berkeley doing protein biosynthesis and drug conjugation. We had nanophysicists at Stanford doing computational nanophysics. And we had molecular imaging and translational science done by brain tumor researchers and brain surgeons at UCSF Medical School. Of these, what I want to tell you, I find the most interesting because it's a supercomputer approach to nanophysics and to what's going on in the body, is the computational nanophysics. And let me tell you a little bit about it with all of these wonderful props that I have brought today. I'm going to start by saying what we discovered was that tumors, when they grow, actually create a wall around their solid tumor, a wall of endothelial cells. But these gatekeepers are not very, very good gatekeepers. They have spaces between them called tumor pores. And these tumor pores vary in size from, let's say, 20 nanometers to 100 nanometers. So let's say these are all the possible pores. It turns out, and was not realized before, that each tumor type has a particular signature, a particular distribution of tumor pores that are available for particles or nanoparticles to sneak into. Okay? Brain tumors are particularly difficult because most of their pores are, what do you think, the smallest, right? So that all of the nanocarriers that were made before that were above 100 nanometers could not get in. So for the longest time, maybe for the last 10 years, we've been trying to just make the particles smaller because it's very difficult for polymeric molecules and particles to be made smaller than 100 nanometers. And so the holy grail for 10 years' time was if we could just get the particles to be really small, like 20 nanometers, we would get so many more of them into the tumor, even a brain tumor. Okay? But what did actually computational nanophysics, the supercomputer at Stanford, actually tell us? It actually told us that all of what we thought, all of how we thought that the bloodstream was like the stream that a submarine could go through and wander through, was completely wrong. It turns out that all of our thinking and our intuition, and even the intuition of most doctors, is based on Newtonian physics, right? So just like when we went to space, we had to learn relativity and how to do a whole new physics to be able to make rocket ships. Now, as we go tiny to the nanosphere level, we have to learn a whole new set of physics rules as well. And these physics rules are not easy to calculate individually with formulas. They had to be calculated by cluster computers, the entire supercomputers at Stanford. And so what we discovered when we ran all of the information that we knew now through molecular imaging, through through all sorts of real-time intravital spectroscopy, all these new imaging techniques, molecular imaging techniques that we had developed, we discovered a number of fascinating, counterintuitive things. So, for example, everyone thought that it would be the best to have a sphere, because a sphere, if it was very small, could carry lots of different drugs inside it, and then if you could get it in, it would release and more drug would be able to get into the tumor. It turns out, though, that that isn't actually what's happening in the bloodstream. What's happening is that, like little ping pong balls, the nanocarriers in the bloodstream actually get knocked out of the bloodstream. The bloodstream isn't like this lovely river that or lake that we saw the submarine going in. It actually is like having spaceships racing by at 600 miles per hour constantly. And these little dust particles of nanoparticles, what happens to them? They get kicked out of the way of the bloodstream and end up in a non-fluid layer that has a totally different physical sort of reality and dimensions than the bloodstream. And once these little particles get in there, they're acted on by these forces that make them almost like Brownian motion. And so these little tennis balls wandering around trying to get to the tumor actually ping around and never drop into. It's like they're all going around and they never drop into the tumor. They just pass it right by. So all of these particles, these very nice nanoparticles carrying drugs, were not getting into the tumor pores. So we said, why is that? Why could it be that even though we created nanoparticles that are small enough to get into this 20 nanometer hole, they're not going in? They're just going right past the hole. What could be going on? And it turned out that the nanophysics and the computational nanophysics actually explained that three-dimensionally, the pores were not holes. They were actually like straws. And that in this physical environment, long, narrow tubes went right past, came to the pore, dropped right in. But the spheres would just go right by. So what would that mean? We had to find someone who could create different shapes of particles that would actually match the 3D structure and nature of the pores so that they would be sucked in. So we ended up working with Berkeley, the nanochemistry area of Berkeley, to develop protein nanocarriers of different shapes. So some tumors, like brain tumors, might like my little long nanorod more than a sphere. But if this was a liver tumor, maybe the sphere would go in and not the nanotube. So these are all the sort of things that we didn't know until we could computationally calculate what was going on at the nanoscale level. So
you have an alignment problem. If your particle is longitudinal, and if you have a cylinder, you still can pass through it without going in. In order to go in, you have to orientate it to be aligned before it can go in. Is that correct?
A very good point. So I'll point out a little later, we actually had created all the different in the past, the only thing we looked at was the size of the particle and the size of the pores. Now that we know all these other things are going on, there are things like how flexible. So sometimes it turns out that something that's flexible gets drawn in and then gets popped in like a straw. Other times, if it's rigid, it actually just passes right by. So it's not just the shape. It's all of these things, because if you think of it, here are these spaceships going by, 7 to 8 micron sized red blood cells. There's the tumor that has an interstitial pressure. There's all these different forces that the differential of the shear force in this tube could be very different for different tumors. And that's what we're discovering, that it is different. That indeed, a flexible one might come by and just bend enough to get zipped in. But one that's very rigid might not. So you're absolutely right. There's a lot of mechanical issues about it, but ones that we've never even thought of looking at before the supercomputer modeling was done. So now, of course, the importance is that now the nanochemists come in to be able to make this 100 to 500 times. We can make maybe 5 times more tumor preferential uptake using physics and the right shape. But it comes to the nanochemists who have developed, let's say this is a molecule, a drug molecule, okay? And what they've done is create special linkages to the nanoparticle, whether it be this shape or this shape, that will actually release in the tumor only at the right pH. So completely pH-controlled release drug molecules allow you to attach 30 or 40 drug molecules to a particular carrier, just like it was a spaceship carrier, tie these to it, and then send it on its way. It brings everything into the tumor for you, and then when it reaches the pH of that tumor, it releases and kills the tumor cells. So a very clever way of doing two things: getting the particle, the nanocarriers into the tumor, and then putting enough drug molecules with a very special way of releasing for the pH so that they can do the most damage once they get into the tumor and not anywhere else. Okay? So the one other thing that I mentioned is I have this little red balloon, because the other thing that this allows us to do is, if we have a particle that we can attach different drug molecules to, we can also attach biomarkers. So now we have two things we can do. We can now estimate much more precisely and predict much more precisely how many nanoparticles are actually getting into the tumor, and by doing that, be able to fine-tune the amount of drug that we put on each carrier. So now we have not only a tracking mechanism that can be looked at from PET and MRI, but we have the drug release. So we're trying to close the loop on a number of different things that have plagued or have made it difficult for nanocarriers to be successful. So, ask, did you like my props? I found those balloons at Toys R Us today. Anyway, so we believe that this is really a game-changing approach to nano drug delivery. And one of the things that we really like about it is all these pharmaceutical companies have spent billions of dollars getting their drugs approved by the FDA. We're not challenging them. We're not competing with all of those drug companies. We're helping them get more of their drug into the tumor. So a very complementary approach that should allow us to be able to use the best of the drugs that are out there already, but target using our tumor-specific computational modeling the shapes and sizes of nanoparticle that will best suit the tumor pores and tumor signature of difficult-to-reach tumors. So the ones we've been working on are glioblastoma, where the median survival is 13.5 months. It is the disease that Beau Biden, the son of Vice President Joe Biden, died of. There's about 15,000 to 20,000 U.S. deaths per year. We'd like to work on liver tumor. There are very many limited treatment options for liver tumor. It is the third leading cause of cancer deaths worldwide, and that's partly because of alcohol. But it's a very difficult cancer to treat. And finally, pancreatic tumors, the tumor that killed Steve Jobs. Median survival is only 6 months. It's the fourth leading cause of cancer deaths. So that's our goal. Our next steps are to get funding for the FDA approval process. So how are we going to do that? That's the rest of my talk. What I did and what I mentioned in my abstract was, here I am, an entrepreneurship professor, but this is the first time I've been a biotech CEO. So I thought, why don't I go and find out who is the best mentor or who has had the best success in life sciences startups? And this person, Steve Blank, is the author of a book called The Lean Launchpad for Startups. And the NSF and the NIH, the two largest funding agencies who have $58 billion in funding, actually worked with Steve Blank to customize his Lean Launchpad startup technique for life sciences. And so the first program was offered in, I think, only a year or two ago at UCSF. And actually, this Life Sciences Lean Launchpad program was an enormous success. And it's one that has been replicated for 500 life science startups. So what was the problem is most people who start up life sciences startups are PhDs and postdocs and faculty members, right? So they've spent their life really narrowly focusing on one thing, the science. But it turns out to bring that science to the clinic or to the bedside or to an FDA-approved drug, you have to do more than that. You actually have to know something about the business and the regulatory process. There are just lots of other things you need to be successful. So here's an example. Why I decided to take the course along with four other people was this video that I saw. Dr. Hobart Harris is the chief of surgery at the UCSF Medical School. He is also a Lean Launchpad Life Sciences startup founder. He took off 7 weeks from his surgery practice to take this program. And this is what he had to say about it.
Thank you. I'm a plastic surgeon. We spend a considerable amount of our time involved in repairing hernias. I came up with an idea that I felt could play an important role in improving the care of especially surgery patients. I began that process by just trying to figure out whether or not it was a scientifically sound and valid proposition. I fell prey to a very common assumption I think naive or inexperienced entrepreneurs suffer, and that is thinking that if your idea works, then all the additional steps required to bring that idea to the marketplace will simply fall like a row of dominoes. And nothing could be farther from the truth. When I entered the Lean Launchpad course, through the interview process, we saw our ideas kind of turned on their head with respect to both pricing and what would be the required information that would compel users to apply our product. The most surprising thing was that the process of actually obtaining regulatory approval would cost somewhere north of $75 million and probably take 4 to 5 years. And that proposition was simply going to be so daunting that it would be very unlikely to garner the required support and resources to pursue that path. I did what I'm sure happened to many others in the course as well. I pivoted, I changed, both in terms of the nature of the product we would develop and the patient population we would first look to serve. It probably would have been years before we would have ultimately realized that we were taking the different, taking an inappropriate tact or approach. The Launchpad Central platform dovetailed beautifully with the course itself and increased the overall efficiency with which we pursued our project and provided us the opportunity to not only document in real time what we were learning, but then to be able to go back. And I've been just amazed at how many things I had forgotten, or tidbits of information that had been collected that at the time did not seem that important, but now were critically valuable to my current level of activity. When I collect the information, I can actually analyze it, group it, link and associate it in a way that allows me to begin speaking and thinking, I think, along the lines of the people I'm going to be interacting with as I follow the regulatory, developmental, and commercial pathway. And I can say there have been probably two or three courses in my entire education that have genuinely changed the way I think. And this would rank as one of those.
So, if you can imagine, when I saw that, I thought, it's being offered. I have a chance of having four UCSF and other postdocs working with me to go and interview 70 people in seven weeks' time and follow the same path. I not only wanted to do it for myself and for my company, but I also wanted to experience it because, indeed, I mean, this is the process that we now do in our class. We do a type of lean launch pad, but with a business model canvas and not maybe the outside interviewing. But here's where I'll show you how the outside interviewing could make a huge difference. Okay, what I'm going to do is just quickly show you the little two-minute video that we created after we had gone through the 7 weeks.
Hi, I'm Amy, the CEO of Nanoforma, a cancer therapeutics startup using nanocarriers for better drug delivery. The problem with a lot of cancer drugs today is that only a very tiny amount gets to the targeted tumor. If only 2% of the drug reaches the tumor, these powerful drugs can't do their job. By bringing together research from UCSF, UC Berkeley, and Stanford, our nanocarriers help solve this problem by getting up to 500 times more drug into a tumor. Here's what we learned getting out of the building.
We thought that deformer would like this technology, so this won't have to do it 5 years down the road. Instead, we learned that their innovation partnering group second to a development. They will even fund early stage research units.
We asked him what his partners wanted to partner with us on, a specific cancer treatment, a drug delivery platform, or a computational discovery tool. We learned that the drug delivery platform has the broadest appeal and applicability after exploring two possible cures.
Surprisingly, we did not fail. We learned how important IP protection is. We can use our platform to partner with standard of care drugs but also rescue powerful cancer drugs that were shelved due to narrow therapeutic windows.
Our meetings helped us refine our minimal viable product. Now we know the data we need for potential licensing and royalty arrangements. We know that upstream manufacturing is feasible and is not cost prohibitive.
Partners are excited about our technology platform, promising data, and our drug delivery startup, bringing together innovations from three top universities. Please contact us to find out more about our research and business roadmap.
So this is the video that we created as part of our final presentation, where all of the groups, there were 24 groups, we were the 24th, that were in the therapeutics area, the diagnostics area, the digital health area, and the biomedical area, all had to go through the 7-week process of going and talking, getting out of the building and talking to people at every box of the business model canvas. So we had to talk to influencers, we had to talk to customers, we had to talk to regulators, we had to talk to all these people and put all that information together, and in the process not only understand better our path and who our potential partners were, and this was also a way where we met 6 or 7 of the people that later are coming back to us now to want to be partners, but we also discovered some very important things about the regulatory process that will make our path a lot easier than we thought. So let me tell you what those were. So we did 71, a number of in-person webcom and phone interviews, and that was our founding team. We first thought when we started, so you had to have your first week, you had to just make a draft of what you thought each of these boxes from key partners to customer segments were. Our big idea was, oh, we're really, really hot, startup with a lot of IP. We'll just sell to Big Pharma and license. What we heard was they didn't think we were ready to license. They were interested in partnering with us to get to the next level. We also heard that everybody out there was really unhappy with their current drug platforms because they are so hard to manufacture. So lots of people were saying, if you can come up with something that is not only is successful and promising in terms of its results, but also is easier to manufacture than a drug conjugate or a monoclonal antibody, this would be really big. So we discovered that we could get co-development partners earlier than licensing customers. We also found that many of the people who wanted to talk to us now wanted to talk to us so that they could help us get to the point where they could license our technology. That indeed it was a longer path, but a co-traveler path. What we heard was that we had to know what each company wanted. We had to, we talked to Sanofi, who was particularly interested in orphan drugs that treated indications that had less than 20,000 people a year, and that there are many, many pharmaceutical companies, including small private pharmaceutical companies, that can be multi-billion dollar companies with 1 or 2 cancer drugs. So they were interested in looking at us for being in that space. Our final business canvas was that we felt that we could go ahead and scale up, particularly because the head of the nanotech characterization lab said that likely we would be classified not as a biologic, which has a lot of difficulty and cost in scaling up, but a non-biologic complex, i.e. combination drug, a carrier plus FDA-approved drug. The nanotech characterization lab has told us that we are a very likely candidate for their program, which is a free program where they help nanocarrier companies get their products to market as part of the NIH and National Cancer Institute. So we heard some amazing economics from Genentech. We discovered that some of their most popular biologic drugs cost $250 a dose, versus if you can use a formulation product, a small molecule drug, it's more like 25 cents. So having a non-biologic complex drug could have unique advantages.
So the cost, that's the cost, not the price.
That's the cost, yeah. The price actually is mostly for hard-to-treat tumors like brain cancer. The average cost is $100,000 per patient per year. So that's the average price. So we believe that we have a minimum viable product. This is a nanodrug delivery platform that tries to look at lots of characteristics, as we heard, of geometry that has never been looked at before as being critical to whether a particle will go into a particular type of tumor. So what we had to do at the end of our presentation and of our program was to say, did we decide after 70 interviews whether we should go ahead or should we close at this point in time? And this is the point of time where we had a lot of positives, and we were one of the few companies of the therapeutics area where everybody felt that we were a go and that we would be getting partnership sort of interest very quickly. So that's the story of my fantastic voyage in the nanomedicine area. So thank you very much.